Hey, this is Dave Infante. Welcome to Fine Pairs Tap Lines, a weekly interview series with brewing icons, industry insiders, and outspoken experts about the United States' most beloved and best-selling beers. It's modern American history, one beer at a time. What does diversity have to do with craft beer, Tap Lines listener? Depending on who you ask, nothing. Or everything. The industry has long been skewered, sometimes lovingly, sometimes less so, as the redoubt of white dudes with beards, and for most of its history here in the United States, that was the dominant aesthetic for its most prominent practitioners. But as I first learned last decade when reporting out a story on America's disproportionate lack of black brewers and brewery owners, those demographics are neither organic nor intractable. Things can change, and to some extent are changing, in the American craft brewing business. And that's thanks, in part, to the tireless efforts of Dr. J. Jackson Beckham. In the mid-2010s, Dr. J. was an academic with a homebrewing habit, blogging incisively about what she called the unbearable whiteness of brewing. It's a great title for a blog post. It's a whole series, actually. Her deep expertise and singular voice eventually caught the eye of the Brewers Association, which tapped her to serve as the trade group's first-ever diversity ambassador in 2018. Today, she joined Tap Lines to reflect on that moment, not only a pivotal one in her own career, but also, I would argue, in the trajectory of the craft beer industry writ large as brewers big and small began trying to square their professed values with their business practices a little bit more intentionally, and ideally, to bring more paying customers to their tap rooms, too. That work is ongoing. Shortly after we recorded this episode in late 2023, she joined the BA full-time as its Director of Social Impact. It's Dr. J. Jackson Beckham. It's the BA's first diversity ambassador. It's rethinking craft brewing's white dudes with beards dilemma. And it's all right here, right now, on Von Pairs Tap Lines. Welcome back, Tap Lines listeners. Joining us today here in the virtual studio, we're graced by the presence of a long-term colleague and source of mine. I would go so far, if I may, to say a pal. We've run across each other several times in our various beer-oriented careers, me covering you as a scholar and as a advocate and many more things. I'm talking, of course, about Dr. J. Jackson Beckham. Dr. J., welcome to the show.
What's up, Dave? How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm so thrilled that you're here today. Where are you joining us from today, Jay?
I am from beautiful and brisk Richmond, Virginia.
Yes. We're actually not so far away from each other, listeners. We recently discovered that we live in close vicinity to one another. Of course, I'm relatively new to the Richmond area. You've been around here for a little while, though, right, Jay?
You know, I have this like interesting history where I feel like I've always lived here, but I have only like technically lived here for 3 years.
Right.
I moved here in March 2020. Mm-hmm. That was an exciting time to close on a house and move.
Very quiet. Very quiet in the real estate market. Yeah.
Totally quiet. Yeah. Fun fact, we could not get a rental moving truck because the moving companies were like, yeah. It's like back early enough in COVID where we had really no idea what was happening.
Right.
So people were like, you got to wear gloves. You got to, you know, like we didn't know what was going on. So.
Oh, yeah. I was still washing my groceries. We were doing that whole thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So moving was a super ridiculous adventure. But I have had like very close friends and my son's father lives here, and I met my wife here. She's a VCU graduate.
Go Rams.
So, yeah, like I've just kind of weirdly been embedded in the city for probably 25 years and just like threw in the towel and was like, let's just move there. It's easier.
You know? Yeah.
Because it just kept coming. So,
right on.
So, yeah, weirdly, new timer, old timer.
Very good. You've had, I feel like, a bunch of different careers. Polymathic, maybe is the term for it. You've pursued some different disciplines. You weren't always working directly in the beer industry, but your educational career, your academic career, also took place here in the general, you know, region of Richmond, right? Where's Randolph in relation to Richmond?
Yeah, so it depends on whether you're talking about my career as an educator. Or my career as a student, but
student.
So as a student, I did my undergrad at Virginia Tech, which mm-hmm. is in Blacksburg. That's Southwest Virginia. So I always tell people, like, down towards the pointy part, right. damn near Tennessee, damn near West Virginia. And then I did my master's degree at San Diego State. So I was actually in San Diego for several years. And mm-hmm. That was a good time. And then I came back east and did my doctorate at UNC Chapel Hill. So, and then once I was kind of back on the East Coast, have been like basically in this mid-Atlantic region. So yeah, left UNC Chapel Hill, went to Charlottesville, which is, you know, an hour and a half down the road from here.
Sure.
I was teaching at a community college there, probably one of the best jobs I've ever had. And then got a faculty appointment at Randolph College, which is in Lynchburg, about an hour and a half south of Charlottesville. And then, you know, eventually left higher ed and plopped here.
Right on. And we're going to talk about that arc today. And we're specifically going to, I think, pick up the story. Where would you like to start the story as we're framing it today? I think typically when we talk about the Taplines time machine, we try to pick a year to scroll back to. 2017-ish sound about right to you?
Yeah, 2017. That would definitely, I think, be the year.
Take us into where Dr. J is and what's going on in 2017.
Yeah, 2017. So I am 2 years into my stint as a professor of communication and cultural studies at Randolph College, which is a tiny liberal arts college. We call them SLACs, small liberal arts college, in Central Virginia. If any of you heard Lynchburg, if you've been following the Falwells at all, so
close personal friends of the Taplines podcast,
exactly.
Jerry Falwell,
Jerry Falwell Jr., pool boy, right? Like the whole arc, right?
The sordid saga of the Falwells, yeah.
That is Lynchburg, right? That's the family sort of built the town. That's where Liberty University is. And then Randolph is like this teeny tiny college on sort of like the other side of town that is effectively the anti-liberty, right? Like,
right.
like small progressive college that's kind of like, you know.
Right.
So that's sort of where I was. Very, a very interesting place. I would say a lot of people like make big eyes, like, woo, when I say that we spent 5 years in Lynchburg.
Right.
Because they're just like, you're a family, you know, same-sex couple with a
so
biracial child. Yeah, what's happening?
So normal and well-adjusted.
Yeah, what's happening? But honestly, Lynchburg is beautiful. It's a beautiful town. There's wonderful folks there, just like everywhere else. A river city, much like Richmond. Same river, it's the James. And yeah, just gorgeous. You know, Central Virginia is gorgeous country. So it's not as... It wasn't like perfect, but it wasn't as fraught as you might think. There's wonderful folks there. So, you know, one of the things about teaching at a small liberal arts college is that you wear a lot of hats. Everybody has to be a generalist. You have to teach a lot of different classes. Everybody has to do a lot of administrative work. Everybody does service work. So you're a busy person.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, teaching a lot of different classes and still trying to remain connected to this research agenda that I had built as a graduate student, which was, you know, about the cultural dynamics of the American brewing industry. Still just like super fascinated by that and, you know, was still trying to find ways to kind of shoehorn it into the work that I was doing. So,
how did you, if I can stop you there for a moment, how did you first become fascinated by that? Where did the fascination start? Because it predates 2017, of course.
Yeah, totally. So I was definitely one of those people that had like the craft beer addictive personality. Like I got in and then immediately I was like I laugh about it now, but I'm thinking about till like 1999, mm-hmm. 2001 or whatever. Like I had this like composition book where I was like writing down everything that I tasted. Yeah, it was like paper untapped, but just for me.
Oh man, you're just doing the little like illustrating the little bottle caps because you didn't have the rating system that Untappd now has.
Yeah.
Talking, totally. Of course, listeners, for those of you who aren't craft beer obsessives, who never did have this part of your journey, so to speak, about Untappd, the ubiquitous ratings app, this was well before, this was honestly kind of, 2001 was kind of before apps, right? The iPhone doesn't hit until 2007 or whatever. Yeah. So, okay. So you're like in it, man.
Yeah. Like I was like weirdly hooked from like, I was like 3 weeks in and I was like, anyway, like that guy immediately.
Yeah.
I was sort of that person who for like many years recognized that there was like a kind of like sticky cultural dynamic happening. I was clearly the only person who looked like me anywhere I went in beer circles. Mm-hmm. But I also am the type of person where that doesn't inherently bother me, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. Like you feel that tension, but it's, you know, I am a person who's used to trafficking sort of spaces where I'm the odd one out, the first or only. And so, you know, personally, I had a personal comfort, but like you also have this global sense where you're like, why is this like this? Mm. Like what is going on? Like this is actually kind of odd. And so I feel like that bug was planted really, really early for me. When I started my graduate program at North Carolina, this was 2007, you know, graduate students need like gas and drinking money. And so I was working at this, we called it a brew and grow. We sold like homebrew supplies and hydroponic organic gardening equipment for your tomatoes. Yes, for best tomatoes.
Having tomatoes is very important as a graduate totally. Student. Yeah. You know this.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we had, you know, five locations of that store between North Carolina and Virginia. And it was cool because the owner was a former academic who like was like, screw it, you know. But he was somebody I respected a lot and we kind of spoke the same language. And he could very quickly sort of gave me a lot of responsibility in the business, even though I was like this part-time grad student. So I was making a lot of decisions about the homebrew stuff, teaching homebrew classes, buying bulk ingredients for mm-hmm. multiple stores, warehouses. And so I get this really cool look at the back end of the brewing industry, and which was for me, like as a homebrewer and somebody who was a little bit obsessed, just really cool, like to be like, wow, like, you know, back then, and there was like all sorts of wonky stuff going on.
Oh, you
there.
Can swear here. This is an adults only 21 plus podcast, man. We can do whatever we want.
Outstanding. Like, do you remember there was like the hop shortage, like 100%. Was going down back then? Yep, so like, you know, so I learned about hop futures, right? And all these like weird financial instruments that were kind of like part of the industry. Mm-hmm. Of course, we were still an industry that was going through like double digit growth in terms of like number of firms and, right? Like it was this wild
dollar sales, volume, everything.
Yeah, everything. Yep. It was wild, right? So at the very same time, I'm starting this this graduate program and I'm in a communication studies department working in what's called cultural studies with a guy named Lawrence Grossberg, who's kind of like the, you know, be all end all of sort of this, what we call the Birmingham School of Cultural Studies. They're all this group of kind of wacky scholars that come from Birmingham, England, and kind of develop this like interdisciplinary practice of cultural studies, which is really about like understanding the current cultural moment and as much complexity as you're willing to take on mm-hmm. for the purpose of like making it better. Right. And so like, as you know, a kind of young graduate student, I'm like, yeah, this is it. Right.
Yeah.
Like one of the big things that, you know, Larry was really big about was like, a lot of people have an object of study, the thing they study. But he was like, your object of study isn't what you're studying, right? You're studying the current cultural moment. Mm. Your object is just your way in. It's just the door that you choose. So, you know, I had this like weird double life where I was like up to my eyeballs in esoteric graduate student stuff. And then I had this kind of like job that I was really, really loving, kind of helping run the homebrew shop. In my hobby time, me and this amazing guy named Ethan, who I haven't talked to for years, but he's incredible. We're like working on organizing this festival that we ran for a couple of years called Homebrew for Hunger. And it was like a pro-am festival, and we raised money for the food bank. And mm-hmm, I was mm-hmm. seeing like how the beer community at the time, if you wanted to leverage it for like good, it was like lightning in a bottle, right? And I, like all these things were like swirling around my head. It's super exciting. And yeah, I walk into Larry's office one day and I'm like, Larry, I'm tired of being like split. I'm tired of being like, you know, all over the place. I want to write my doctoral dissertation about the cultural dynamics of the beer industry because I'm in it, you know, and I can tell all sorts of weird crap is going on. So, you know, right. So this is 2008. Right. Financial crisis is upon us, right? And people are buying more beer, spending more for it. The industry is diversifying instead of contracting. Mm-hmm. We're adding more firms instead of consolidating. Like, it's doing the backwards of what any industry had any business doing in the height of the financial crisis. And I was like, that's a compelling question. I want to understand why. I want to understand what's going on behind this industry, because it's not just like supply demand economics. That's right. Not what's happening here. It acts too weird and too funny. So he was like, promise me you won't blame me if you never get a job. And I was like, deal. true story.
That's a good advice. I like that advice. Yeah. He's got to abdicate. Yeah. Responsibility there. Yeah.
He don't want to be on the hook.
You have to sign a waiver, just like when you go skydiving. You were going academic skydiving.
That's
basically.
Right. Yeah. He's a total realist. Once I started getting into that project, it was like, oh, okay. Like this, the beer thing is so weird and so wild and so awesome. And so I was a different sort of graduate student. I didn't have the luxury to sort of work on my dissertation, you know, continuously and then get it done quickly. Mm-hmm. My wife, we weren't married at the time, but like I had my
significant other.
My wife and I were together. Yeah. You know, Miles, our son was a baby. So I had like family to take care of. And I was just like, I would love to sit around here and like drink in dive bars and talk about philosophy, but I have to get a grown-up job so I can support my family. So I started teaching at community college before I finished the PhD. So my first 2 years teaching at community college, I was also finishing the dissertation. So defended it in 2014, fast forward to 2017. So I've done a lot of teaching. I'm doing a lot of stuff and I'm still kind of looking for ways to reach back to that work because I'm like that work. It really was kind of so central to me. And it's easy to lose track of it when you have to teach like a jillion sections of intro to public speaking. Or
sure.
Yeah. So I'm kind of thinking about ways to get back to where that is. I'm doing a lot of writing.
I was going to say, you'd also been writing pretty extensively at this point about the beer industry, right?
Exactly. Yeah, so I kind of was coming through as this kind of like writer, social critic, sometimes Twitter flamethrower, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm trying to find my way kind of to talk about the industry. And I got invited to do a plenary talk at the North Carolina Brewers Guild Conference about specifically diversity in the brewing space, which was like at the time a fairly new conversation.
Right.
I had made some great contacts in North Carolina just because I had done all my field research for the dissertation at breweries around town. So like I probably all the breweries in the Durham area east kind of remember this like weird lady like sitting in the corner like writing. So those contacts kind of remained. And, you know, someone who was took an officer role at the North Carolina Guild was like, hey, Jay, would you give a talk on this? Right. So that was like my first kind of conference industry talk. Mm-hmm. And I finished the talk. We went over to a brewery to drink. I can't remember who it was, where we were, but I'm standing around. I don't know anybody. I'm just holding a beer randomly. And this like tiny person, like walking like they have bricks in the bottom of their feet, walks up to me and is like, so what are you going to do with that? Right. And I'm, of course, talking about Julia Hertz. Because if you've ever been around Julia, that like she's a she's like 4 feet nothing or maybe 5. Julia will listen to this and be like, "What the hell, Jay?" but she walks around like a 6 foot person, and she cuts straight to the quick every time. She's like, "What are you gonna do with this?" And I was like, "What? You know, like what are you gonna do with this? What are you gonna do with what you said with the information? Yeah. What are you gonna do with it? You know?" And like literally in my mind, I'm like, "I've done what I've professed." Right, like because I'm a professor, like that's what I've done. I have professed the words.
That's no longer my problem. I did the thing that I came here to do, and now it's on the rest of you. Yeah,
which is super ridiculous, but great in the way it is. So I don't know what like the backstory is, but I suspect that Julia did what Julia does, which is like see opportunities and dive all the way in.
Right? Yeah. I was going to say, just for listeners who aren't familiar, Julia Hers is a longtime affiliate of, official of, she's held a lot of different roles at the Brewers Association, which is, of course, the craft beer industry's largest trade group. They're based out in Boulder. Do you know why she was there? Was she just making the rounds at the guild?
She was speaking also.
Gotcha.
So Julia was, at that time, she was the director of the craft beer program for the BA. And Julia is probably one of our more like dynamic speaker travelers. So yeah, she was on site doing her thing there and made the connections, you know. So that's 2017. Toward the end of that year, I got a kind of ping from... Her name is Fawn. She was the AD of the North Carolina Brewers Guild at that time, and she's a KJ. The Brewers Association is looking for this for like a subject matter expert to help their diversity, their new diversity committee. You know, this is, they call this role diversity ambassador. It's contract, it's part time, you know, thought of you, passed your name along, right?
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, that's really interesting. You know, so the first thing you have to do is, as a faculty person, right, a full-time faculty person, you have to clear that with your dean and all the stuff, because as an academic, it's called faculty consulting. Mm-hmm. And usually there's some pretty specific restrictions about, around how much of it you can do, for what purpose, et cetera. My institution, Randolph College, was really great and generous about working with me to do faculty consulting. And the idea is usually like, is it related to your research agenda, like your research expertise?
And for me, I'm assuming they also are, hey, is it going to get the college's name out there? Is it going to be in a good light that's not going to reflect poorly on us, that type of thing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, cleared it with the college, which was great. I remember one of the first conversations I had was with the chair of the DEI committee at the time. That was Julie Verratti, at a Denizens Brewing in the, you know, DC, Maryland area.
Maryland, yeah, yeah.
And I remember Julie was just like brutally candid. Like, we're some well-meaning people who do not have the expertise or very much lived experience, and we need help, you know? And I remember thinking at that time that, like, I don't know that I would have considered it unless she was that candid about, you know, their position at the time. And so, you know, continued in conversations, talking about what the role was about. And, you know, people are always asking me, like, you know, what did you do to get prepared for that role? And I always joke that I was like, I've been training for that job, like since I was, like, in high school, like, pounding Red Dogs, you know.
right.
So, like,
well, did you? You know. I think that maybe that's a good moment to pause here, because one of the things that occurred to me in preparing for this episode is, like, you know, I think that at this point your name is, if not synonymous with DEI efforts in the craft brewing industry, you're certainly one of the names that's very much in the mix, very much at the fore in terms of these efforts, because you've been, you know, since 2018, we'll talk about more of this later on the episode, but you've been doing this work explicitly, you know, with the BA, alongside the BA, you know, in tandem at your, you know, your firm, whatever. But I'm curious, when this opportunity arises, when Julia sort of buttonholes you in 2017, and then you get the call about the diversity committee, in your career, had you thought of yourself as like a DEI professional at that point? Because it seems like maybe not so much. That wasn't the track you were on.
Yeah, this is super interesting. So I would definitely not have identified as a DEI professional. In fact, I probably would have like balked at the term at the time. Yeah. So like, if you can think about it, higher ed, generally progressive spaces. Certainly, I was at a progressive institution at the time. I went through probably more compulsory DEI training than most people do in their whole careers, right? Like, like re-up every year. I did it all. And I, you know, I was in a lot of different roles in higher ed in terms of like committee work and appointments. And so, you know, I served for a while on our institution's institutional review board. So like, that's, for those of you out there, that's the IRB. Anytime you do human subjects research, like where you're researching people, you have to go this huge review process to make sure your research is ethical. And like, the IRB is who does that. So, you know, because I served on IRB, I went through even more training about power and ethical dynamics. I did a lot of work with the student athletes at my school. I was a student athlete and have always been really connected to sports. And so like Title IX was huge for the work I was doing there. So I had to do a lot of Title IX training. So I went through like a dumb amount of training. And one of the things that was like first in my mind was, this training is horrible. Like, I hate it. at the end of every compulsory training, I was like angry and like exhausted. And I would always have to be like, at the end, be like, you just went through that because it's an effort to like improve your experience.
Right,
like,
right.
Buddy, like you're the person who might like benefit most from everybody having to go through this. And I hated it.
Right. It's a very that's a very bad sign, right?
Right. Yeah. And so
it's compulsory for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. And so I remember when I took the role, like my very first kind of commitment to myself was like, I am going to do this differently. Mm. I'm going to educate people about these issues and these topics, which were super central to my education and cultural studies, to like the work I was doing, like have a huge kind of, you know, educational theoretical background in it. And I just was like, I'm going to do this for a place I love, for a space I love, an industry I love, and I'm going to make it not horrible. Like that was kind of like the one thing that I wanted to accomplish when I took that role. Like I was like, I don't want people to come to my talks or read one of my white papers or go through a training and be like, God, that sucked at the end, right? Like I wanted people to be like interested, engaged, inspired. And I think that was really important to me. I've kind of grown into the title DEI professional. But I think at the time I was just more trying to like have an impact in a way that I thought, one, the industry really, really needed, but like two, in a way that like felt better than what people were doing in other spaces.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You had gone through sort of what wasn't working or what you felt like wasn't working, and this was an opportunity to take a crack at it in your way in a lane that you had become really familiar with because of your interest in craft beer and because of your work at the homebrew shop and because of your dissertation, like all. So these things are coalescing then, it sounds like.
Yeah, right. And literally was like everything was like, yeah, you know, came together. And like, funny enough, like, I was like, yeah, what's the role? What are you hoping people will do? Right. And they were kind of like, well, at the time, there's lots of ambassadors at the BA. And primarily their job was sort of to take this huge wealth of sort of technical resource knowledge that the BA has assembled over the years and sort of translate that for the average Brewers Association member. Mm-hmm. So like, here's what you really need to know. Here's the resources. Here's how to activate them, et cetera. Right. So it's sort of like the connecting the dots there. And mostly the ambassadors were working through state guilds. Right. So speaking to state guilds. And to regional audiences. So there was a sustainability ambassador at the time, Matt Stensfield. He and I are still really good friends. Sustainability ambassador, really good dude named Ian. You know, Neil Witte was working as a draftline quality ambassadors. Yeah, so there was all these people kind of leveraging their subject matter expertise sort of help folks around the country. And so the kind of one difference between like my ambassadorship and the other ones is that there were no best practice resources or like library of resources for me to go like translate to the rest of the community. I had to create them.
Right. There was no body of work that you were going to like take forward to the guilds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the idea was like, can you sort of, you know, collect and use data so we can like understand more about what's happening related to this issue? And I was like, yeah, I'm a data monkey. I'm an academic. That's what I do. You know, can you like create educational materials and teach? And I was like, yeah, that's literally what I do. Right. And like, and also, do you know something about craft beer? And I was just like, you know, at that time I was BJCP certified and had been homebrewing for years and, you know, had worked in the shop and was familiar with a lot of ally trade. So it was just like this bizarre opportunity to put it all together. And that, of course, I said yes.
So first ever diversity ambassador, you're going to be working with the diversity committee, which is created by the BA. upstream of this in 2017, when does the role start? I mean, it's a part-time role, so you're still teaching at this point, right? You're still at Randolph. You've got approval for faculty consultation. You say yes to the BA. What happens next?
My very first day on the job was CBC 2018.
Okay.
So, first day on the job was giving a talk at CBC.
Where is it that year? I forget.
That Nashville. It's in Nashville. I have no idea what to expect. But there are I give two talks, and there's, at one in particular, there's 200 people in the room. And I remember being like, whoa, there's a lot of people here, right? Mm-hmm. At the time, it seemed like a group of people who were kind of starving to hear what I was saying. I was getting the keep going head nods.
Yeah, very leaned in type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, it sort of just kind of took off from that moment, took off from that moment. I would say within a couple of months, individual breweries started reaching out and being like, we know you're doing this role. We saw you talk here. Could you do some work with us directly? Mm-hmm. Right. And so pretty quickly I started taking on, individual consulting projects for breweries here and there, facilitation, some training, talks, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I did that, all of that for about 2 years before I started, asking the really serious question, you are working a whole lot, you are juggling a lot of travel with your course load, with your research responsibilities. I was just about to go up for tenure at Randolph, and putting together a tenure binder in case is a huge deal. If that makes sense, you're just
What is, for those who have never made it through academia, in brief, what are we talking about here? Just all of your work in one document? What do you mean by a tenure binder?
So you have to make your case for tenure.
Okay.
I think when tenure, it gets often described as you're unfireable, but it's not exactly what it means. But you start as a assistant professor. Then once you get tenure, you become an associate professor. And then if you become a full professor, that's a thing down the road. Mm-hmm. So tenure basically is a process by which you have been around probably 6 or 7 years. It's very weirdly biblical. So you usually go for tenure in your seventh year.
Okay.
And so you basically are saying I have made the case that I am now a foundational part of this institution's operation and worth being an embedded part of what happens here. And yes, it is hard to separate from a professor who has been granted tenure. So usually you have a whole lot of narrative that sort of talks about what we call the three prongs of academia. So what you are doing in the classroom. So it might be things your syllabi, some lessons plans, learning objectives, analysis of your student evaluations, data analysis of your student evaluations, awards you've won, professional development you've gone through, et cetera. And so you sort of just lay out your case of this is why I'm an excellent educator. And then the second prong of that is usually your research. So same thing, things you've written, publications, and you put full copies of everything in there, right?
Yeah.
So if you published 3 journal articles, then all 3 of them go in there, right?
Do your blog posts go in there? Would you be considering putting, for example, listeners, for those who aren't familiar, you wrote a series of blog posts called The Unbearable Whiteness of Brewing, Dr. J, back in, 2012 or so? A while back, before you and I had ever spoken. Does that stuff go in there? Are you thinking about putting stuff, publications like that in there? Is it more peer-reviewed stuff?
Yeah, so both. I put both in there because my tenure case was also grounded on what I called sort of life of being a public intellectual, which and a lot of institutions highly valued, right? This idea that I can cross the ivory tower or the fence around the campus and talk to average readers and catch their attention. So yeah, so all that stuff is going in my tenure case. And then you have your service. That's the third prong. So you've got teaching, research, service. And service is usually service to the institution and service to the broader greater good, right? Mm-hmm. So it might be like, I've been on these committees, I've volunteered in these particular ways, I've advised this many students, whatever. So tenure binders are usually, depending on the institutional standards, I would say I've seen them at about 150 pages. I've seen them at about 300 pages. Takes a very long time to put them together. And you really are kind of like submitting your future, like, please, when you send them up.
So you arrive at a threshold where this is coming up. This is everything you've worked for at that point in your career, right? Like, so you have a tenure track role. You've got the opportunity. This is a culmination of sorts of a lot of the work you've put in. But you've also got this interesting other thing cooking at the BA, this diversity ambassadorship.
Right.
So that's a crossroads.
Yeah, major, major. And I still tell people it was the biggest decision I ever made in my life. Mm. Leaving academia, it absolutely sounds – anybody who's never done it is going to be like, that sounds ridiculous. But it is a divorce. Mm. It is a divorce. Like, you mourn for a very long time because it takes so long to get there, right? Like what you just described was the tip of the iceberg. It started in 1995 when I started my undergraduate degree, So, like, degrees later, teaching later, research later, you know, this has been, you know, damn near 25 years of my life with a single-minded goal, you know, six figures worth of student loan debt.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I have given... I lived in places I wouldn't have lived because I was pursuing education or educational jobs, right? Like, it is...
You made huge sacrifices to get there.
It is the, it is the thing that I organized at that time more than half of my adult life around.
Yeah.
And choosing to walk away from it was a bigger, more devastating decision than I can put into words. Mm. Well, no, I put it into words and I had to write about it, but... But it's still not adequate. It was a lot. It was a lot. It was a lot.
Because it's not just the work, but it's also the culture. I'm curious, like, you're going from one very, like, robust and well-defined and at times esoteric and unique culture in academia to another that is also nascent and, you know, to some extent esoteric in the craft beer industry, much more dominated by the vagaries of the market maybe, but I mean, that's gotta be jarring on a cultural level too for you, right?
Yeah, to some degree, but I also will say that I, as much as I loved academia, I was also never a great fit, if that makes sense. Like, it's as much as I loved all of it, I could also look at it at the same time and be like, you guys, we're bullshitting a lot. Do you know what I mean? Like, I always felt like, you know, I was always a little bit, I don't know, suspect of everything that was going on. And then, you know, I think what really put it home for me is, like, I always tell people, like, I didn't leave academia because I was tired of being an academic. I left academia so I could be a better academic. Right? If, like, teaching... research service is what we do as academics. What I realized is that, like, when I talk to a guild and I'm giving a talk and I'm talking about, you know, actionable solutions to something that lots of people are experiencing, and people are making eye contact, they are leaning in, they are taking notes, they're talking to me after the talk, I'm like, wow, that teaching landed. Whereas 90% of my classrooms are full of, like, bored 19-year-olds who, like, were like, I'm here because I don't want to enter the workforce yet, right?
This is a major requirement, and that is why I'm sitting in front of you right now.
Yeah, that's right. And I realized, like, the teaching felt better in the professional space of craft beer. My research was industry-driven, so, like, people could take the research that I did and be like, okay, now I will use this for this reason. Like, it was immediately applicable, actionable research that, like, doesn't need to have, you know, 17 pages of fluff so that reviewer number two at the academic journal will deign to, you know, accept it. Right. It was like research that mattered and was pure, and you didn't have to, like, pay homage to all the people who studied the topic before you. Like, I was like, oh gosh, like, this is what research is when it feels good, right? And it doesn't just feel like fussy. And then the service work, right? Like, it's advocacy. I'm doing social justice advocacy. I'm trying to serve a greater good. And so, you know, objectively, I was like, yeah, I'm a better academic in craft beer than I am at a university. And so I think that was a key part of the decision. And I think the other was just, you know, the sausage of higher ed is crap. You know, I spent time as a department chair paying adjunct instructors. Like, for those of you who might not know, your adjunct instructors are not professors, full-time professors at the institution. They just pick up a class here or there. Paying people $2,000 or $3,000 to teach a whole semester of a class, right? And they have the same degrees I do. Like, there's a weird power imbalance between, like, did you win the tenure track lottery, or are you destined to be a underpaid adjunct for forever? All institutions have to make enrollment, and I think a lot of families get pressured into taking out loans that are not in their best interests. Like, there was some, like, I was having a really hard ethical moment with higher education.
Because you're on the other side of it as someone who's the department chair at that point, and these are now, you're a part of the system no matter what you're apprehensions or critiques of the system may be. You're still responsible by the virtue of your role for carrying out its function.
Yeah, that's right.
That's hard.
It's super hard. And, like, am I like, oh, college is for suckers? Absolutely not. You know, I still love higher ed. I love the institutions I've worked for. That's not it at all. I just, you know, personally, it was really, really hard to kind of, like, show up every day and give it my all and go to bed and feel good about myself at night when I was like, there are parts of this structure that just don't feel right to me.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So, Jay, you come on with the BA as the first ever diversity ambassador in 2017. You and I spoke that year. I think I interviewed you for a piece that wound up running in the New York Times just like 6 months after I filed it. Thanks a lot, New York Times. But so that's like right around like mid to late 2018. That's when that story goes live. But you're also on the move yourself, because as we just discussed, you're making your decision to divorce academia, as you describe it. What, you know, the diversity ambassadorship with the BA is a part-time role. What fills the other part of your time once you leave academia?
Yeah, such a great question. So because I was like slowly picking up like other consulting work as a result of sort of the ambassadorship, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm going to, you know, start a consulting firm, you know, and that's going to be the new job. So I'm going out on my own. And it's a wild. So not only was I divorcing, I also was like, I'm going to be a entrepreneur, freelance, you know, I don't like something.
Right.
It takes a very long time to leave academia. And I was trying to be as ethical as I could with my institution. So if those of you who might not know, hiring a full-time tenure track position takes about a year. Like, they have to approve the position. Most people apply for jobs in the fall. All those applications are reviewed over the fall. Early interviews happen in like January, February, and then they make appointments in like March, and then they start teaching. So it's like a year-long process to get hired. And so I actually told my institution I was leaving like a year before I left, so that they would have a time to start a hire without having a gap from my departure. So it was a very weird thing, right? And there's no going back, right? Like, once you can't.
The cat's out of the bag. Never mind. Right,
There's no going back. So I started the process in 19. I'm still working full time, but I'm also at the same time like ramping up consulting business, because I know that that needs to be like my main gig by like summertime, right? So everything's going on. Thinking back, I'm like, whoa, buddy, like, you were not sleeping, you know?
That was a bad decision.
Yeah, like, in hindsight, I'm like, never again. But, you know, I was teaching full time. I was doing the ambassadorship gig. I was doing a lot of private consulting. That's when we founded Craft by EDU, nonprofit. Like, it was just like everything all at once, like, you know. And then the plan, you know, was, you know, we're going to buy this little house in Richmond. We're going to spend, you know, 2-3 months kind of with our rental in Lynchburg and the house in Richmond, sort of, you know, we bought this little old bungalow. We're going to fix it up. We're going to kind of go back and forth. It'll be real comfortable transition time. And then, like, COVID drops and, like, everything changed because all of the work that I had lined up for myself with either public speaking or on-site consulting and, like, all of the work went away, like, immediately.
Wow.
So we were like, we can't afford to live in two places. We have to save every penny. So, like, we moved into the house I'm in right now in Richmond before even starting renovations. Air mattresses. We didn't have a fridge. Like, the house didn't have a refrigerator. We had coolers.
Yeah.
There's like tailgate, like my tailgating chairs are in the living room. It just looks like we're camping in the house. Like we're squatting in my own house. Luckily my kid's father, you know, he could stay over there, but like we were roughing it for a little while. And I had no idea what I was going to do, to be honest. Like, I had already like left the job. I was still teaching through the end of the year, but it was the COVID year, right? So like higher ed was like, don't come, okay, classes are canceled. Right. Everything just stopped. So I think the 2020 story was just like finding my way back to like the firm, back to Crafted for All, what would become Crafted for All and what people would need. You know, I would say one of the other like weirdly difficult things that I will always have in my life is that the murder of George Floyd was like this freakishly disruptive moment for our country, for people of color. Like, I think in terms of like collectively felt trauma and exposing the degree of polarization that we're capable of as a country, like, I think that's one of the like most kind of publicly traumatic moments that we've ever been through in my lifetime after 9/11. Right. I think of like, weirdly, those two moments really stand. You know, I'm 46 on Friday. And I think like those two moments stand out to me as these like giant ruptures that like you can't think the way you used to think after those moments happen. But I will also say that like that is the moment where the industry saw the value I was presenting as a consultant with Crafted for All. And had that moment not happened, I have no idea where I would be, right? Because I literally, over the space of 48 hours, went from, honey, I think I'm going to Home Depot to put in an application, to I don't have enough waking hours to take all the phone calls I'm getting.
Whoa.
Right. And I still don't know what to do with that, right? Like, in terms of like cognitive dissonance, that like there is absolutely no disputing the fact that like that tragedy led to a lot of the success that I have had since. Right.
That's a grotesque detail to countenance, right? Like that's a really hard tension. I feel like it's worth, if you'll indulge me for a moment, like dwelling on that for a minute or trying to interrogate it a little bit. Like, I think something you often hear in mainstream discourse, especially coming from the American right wing or the global right wing, is this vilification of DEI, you know, as sort of a cynical expression of like, you know, race hustling, for example, is like an old term, but that same idea, right? Like, you often hear it castigated as such. And that cynicism is, I'm pretty comfortable saying, it's basically all done in bad faith. But like, there is nevertheless a relationship between the worst things that happen to people of color in this country, to other marginalized groups in this country, and the industry of DEI. And like, again, like, I think that that critique is fully in bad faith, and that's not what I bring forward. But what you're describing is ultimately like a lot more interesting and more nuanced, which is that like, well, that relationship, like, it exists whether you like it or not.
That's right.
So now what do we, how do we proceed here? How did you proceed, Jay?
I carried it as a personal responsibility. I'm not sure that was the healthiest choice, I'll be honest there. But like, for me, it was this sort of idea that like, if my small business and me personally, are going to thrive and benefit as a result of this, then like it is my responsibility to give it everything I have, right? To try to prevent anything like this from happening again, or to like muffle the shockwaves, right? And so, you know, I've been pretty candid over the years about like my difficulties in like modulating myself in terms of like work-life balance, or as I like to call it, work-work balance. And I think a lot of that came from that sense of responsibility. Like I always felt that I owed it, right? Like to the broader project. And so slowly coming to like a healthier relationship with that sense of responsibility. But I think that's the only way I could move forward, you know, and be okay with it. So I don't have a strong no muscle, you know, that's like a lot of people are always like, I don't remember who it was, but someone was like, anytime I get started with any project vaguely related to DEI, like you are always standing at the end of the tunnel, Jay. And I was just like, yeah, I don't say no a whole lot. And yeah. I think a lot of it came from like, if you have it, give it.
Yeah.
Right. And I think what I'm finally coming to see is like, now you don't have what you used to have, right? Mm. So you have to be smarter and more strategic about it.
In terms of your personal like energy and ability to apply yourself everywhere all at once? Gotcha.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also the like, I have a very good friend, still a professor. She's at Miami of Ohio. We've been close friends for lots of years. And she likes to say that I have cowboy ethics. So like very much like, yes, no. You know, like a kind of like etched in stone kind of ethics. And I think sometimes that I can be the type to kind of like minimize things like compassion fatigue or secondary trauma or things along those lines. Like I was just like, they just weren't things I was really thinking about. And I think it wasn't until, you know, probably 2002 that I started like really seeing the signs of some of these things happening, where I was just like, well, you really have to figure out what's going on with you.
2022.
Yeah.
2022. Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. To where I kind of was like, wow, there is a toll here that you haven't been paying attention to that you need to start paying attention to.
Right? Yeah.
Which I think a lot of people are hitting that point, to be honest. I don't think I'm the only one.
No, certainly not. I mean, I think, you know, we talk a lot about sort of individual burnout, but I think there's also, you know, a social burnout or collective burnout that we're all experiencing, or many of us are experiencing as a country. Definitely buy that. Jay, I want to like, by way of, I know, are you good to go for another few minutes here? Is that okay?
Yeah. Yeah. All right, no, cool. Totally fine.
By way of sort of bringing it all back around to the work that you started doing, you know, well before the BA ever came calling, and then, you know, the role that you sort of fell into or found yourself into, it clicked all together with all your experience, you know, as the diversity ambassador, and then that becomes Craft EDU, then that becomes, you know, Crafted for All, the consulting firm that you operate. You've had, to my mind, probably the closest or most hands-on, most front row seat to the temperature or the overall vibe or zeitgeist in craft brewing vis-a-vis its longstanding sort of, let's say, difficulty or opportunity, maybe is a more charitable way to say it, with the diversity or lack thereof of both its, you know, its workforce and then also its consumer base. You and I have talked about this over the course of years, but you've been at it for much longer than I have. I'm curious, you know, not your entire career, but maybe like looking at, you know, 2017 or so versus 20, you know, now we're speaking at towards the end of 2023, you've mentioned sort of obliquely a few different shifts, you know, in the way the industry is thinking and talking about DEI. Some of those are probably shifts that you have indirectly or sometimes directly helped to enact through your work. If you could sort of zoom out and characterize, you know, the nature of the changes that you've seen with regards to the industry's approach to and vocabulary around diversity, how would you characterize that shift?
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, I've been thinking about this so much lately. I just wrote about it, published it on Craft for All blog. But I think I've characterized it as a kind of group of paradigm shifts, which like is so like the kind of academic asshole in me, right? Like I had to go paradigms. But like it's true, right? Like if a paradigm is like a collection of ideas and a collection of underlying assumptions that like shape how you understand what's going on around you, we've absolutely been doing that. Right. So I think first we were kind of in this space where we were doing like consciousness raising. So, I think of that. This is like we were in this consciousness raising paradigm where we the kind of underlying assumption there is that like people just don't know. Right. Like if they knew that there were these kind of like disparities in who's in the industry and how they're experiencing the industry, then things will change. All we need to do is just like make people aware. Right. So like I kind of internally call this the era of the panel discussion. Like, do you know what I mean? Like we would
sure,
we kept assembling all these panels, usually of people from underrepresented groups to just like talk about it.
Right.
Like, you know, I was on that panel a million times. Like sure. I've seen that panel a million times. So I think we were there for like a while. And then I think like pretty quickly we got to like this like, okay, now what? Right. Like our people would listen and be like, oh my gosh, my brain's on fire. That's awesome. What do I do? Right. Like there was like this, we came up against the edge of that and we're like, yeah, just talking about it isn't going to get us later. So right. Then we kind of shifted to this like, okay, it has to be business, you know, like we have to like embed it in people running businesses. And so we kind of made this hard shift to sort of like this business development space, right? And that's where a lot of people got a lot of compulsory training in the business space, unfortunately. But, you know, the idea was just like business leaders need to kind of assume responsibility for this and like build it into how they're running businesses, which is, you know, I think a great evolution, but that has some shortcomings, right? Like one of the biggest shortcomings, I think, is that once you kind of put that conversation in the business space, all these people who are advocates and activists who are passionate about craft beer but aren't in the industry themselves get written out of the discussion. And that kind of like exclusivity that they're kind of like bringing under a microscope is just reproduced all over again, right? It's also slow, right? If anybody's ever trying to like change a business culture, you know that is like a long process that takes a lot of dedication. It's not a one-off training. You know, you can't have the person like drop in and be like, good, now you're good, you know?
Right, right.
So, you know, I think we've kind of moved over there. I think the rat magnet, like brands, Instagram, Me Too moment,
sure.
craft beer, I think hard marks another change. And I kind of think of that as this like crisis response paradigm where, you know, we're kind of looking back at consciousness raising. We're looking back at this business development and we're like, not good enough. Right? Like, like things are in crisis for some people right now. People are undergoing harm, both physical and psychological. We have bad actors, right? And so the tactics get like escalated, right, at that point. And like, again, there is good and bad here. Like the kind of virility of that moment, particularly as it's like, you know, using social media as its kind of main way of distribution, puts the conversation in everybody's mouth, right? It gets outside of beer,
right?
Like it really does kind of raise up the ante in terms of awareness, which I think is ultimately good. It, you know, democratizes the platform. Lots of people get their voices heard. And I think that's really important as well. I think the other side of that coin is that like, we got really, really, really stuck on like public exposure, public shaming as like the way to do accountability. And there was little thinking about like, what is the road to redemption, right? Or like, how do we get people to get away from the bad place and get to the better space, right? Like it became really tough, right? And so, and then certainly that bought into kind of like the polarized rhetoric that was like already overlaying our country, right? Like then the moment you kind of get like public exposure, boycott, accountability, then you got the other people like, what, cancel culture, right? Like, and then as soon as you're there, then like, you're mapping onto this like really heated pre-existing space of polarization, and which is
unproductive.
Super unproductive and really, really challenging. And then, you know, one of my biggest, you know, probably the thing that hurts my heart the most is that like, those conversations don't often get pulled off of social media, right? They stay on social media. And social is just not a good place for complexity, for nuance, for understanding. Like, you can't unpack an argument in, you know, 280 characters. So that was an important moment, and I think a lot of great stuff came out of it. And then I would say, like, this kind of last space that we tend to operate in, I call it sort of the opportunity-making space, which is really about, maybe this isn't just about like overt bias and bad actors. Maybe this really is like, we're in a capital intensive industry that for at least a small amount of time was primarily financed by people who had access to generational wealth, right? Doesn't mean they were necessarily wealthy, but it might mean they don't have a crap load of college loans, right? Or they might have a family home they can use to secure a loan. Like, like there's a... there's a financial structure behind like who can afford and who can be granted a loan for six figures worth of stainless steel, right?
Right.
And so the opportunity making space is like, we don't really need to tell people what to think. We just need to provide the opportunities for people who come from underrepresented backgrounds to sort of close some of the gaps. And you see a lot of organizations that I've been associated with, like Michael Jackson Foundation, right? Really sit in this paradigm where it's like, you know, we're just about playing opportunities. I think we're at a bit of a, I won't say crisis, but we are certainly at this like inflection point as people who do this work in the industry, because what I've seen, especially over the last year, is that people who are embedded in different paradigms of the work are starting to do some infighting, right? So like, instead of saying like, oh, the work you do helps overcome the shortcomings of the work I do, let's work together. There, it's more like, eh, you're not whatever enough, and like, never the twain shall meet. So I think, you know, one of the things that I'm looking at over the next, you know, couple months is really laying out a case that like, there's no bad, right? Like, all of these paradigms that I spoke about have utility, and like, they cover each other's shortcomings. And so rather than being like four separate camps, I think they need to be like four branches of the same whole. And, you know, I think if there's any sort of vision I have for like this work going forward, or for my role in it specifically, I think that's it, right? To like unify and kind of get everyone who's invested in the kind of project of social advocacy and craft beer rowing in the right direction, you know, and that doesn't necessarily have to be the same direction. I just think it has to be like coordinated. And to realize that like we're well positioned to rise to a lot of the challenges that the industry is going through right now. And I think that's never been more evident than now.
Well, that's a high note to end on. Tell me what you mean by that. Tell listeners what you mean by that.
I think, I mean this in a couple of different ways, right? I think the easiest way, simplest, right, one plus one, two, is in terms of market share, right? You know, our industry has matured. We are not growing like gangbusters as we were, like we talked about in the previous years. We're flattening. The number of breweries opening and the number of breweries closing is starting to kind of do this, you know? And there's more and more competition, both in a from the regulatory environment and from the consumer taste environment, from other products, and can, you know, especially from like what we'll call fourth category stuff, like RTDs, your seltzers, things along those lines. So I think in one regard, right, craft beer has to get new drinkers and new occasions, right? So like, we need people who maybe weren't turned on to beer in the past. And we need beer to be more sort of flexible about like finding its way into different sorts of
as a liquid in a marketing vehicle, not as an industry. Obviously, the industry creates those things, but we're you're talking about like how it occupies contexts in drinkers' daily lives.
You know, so like if people are like, ah, you know, Sitting around watching the game, beer occasion.
Sure.
Going out for a fancy dinner, wine occasion. Mm. We need beer to start like pushing harder on that, like other occasions, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. That are usually not beer occasions. And so for me, a lot of that means, you know, diversifying the markets we're in. You know, we still don't have great, you know, market penetration among non-male, non-white groups. Mm. And there's still plenty of opportunity. Plenty of opportunity. So, you know, I think, and those people will bring new occasions, right, with them. So the opportunity there is still massive. And I don't, you know, I think we can't lose track of that. But I think the second part, and maybe the part that resonates a little bit more with me, you know, I think the last few years has been a referendum on the conditions of the American worker. Mm. It started before COVID, but COVID certainly, you know, brought it to the fore in terms of pay, remote work, et cetera. You know, we talk about like the kind of inflation in relation to wage, right? Wage change, and that like the American worker is like actually making less money today than they've made, you know, for years and years and years because things are getting more expensive and wages aren't going up that much. That's been true like before COVID, right? But like we've only really been talking about it in the kind of public imaginary for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I think our industry in particular, you know, obviously we have like a relationship with alcohol to think about. We have an industry that's kind of got notoriously tight margins. We don't have a great history of providing extensive benefits in our industry, right? We as an industry have prioritized the liquid. Mm. Above all else for a long time. And I think the other, for me, big opportunity is like to do the people work, right? To kind of bring the people side up to the quality of the liquid side. And we think of those benefits as often deferred and intangible. And I think that's absolutely untrue. Mm. You know, right now there are breweries that I've worked with and that I have good relationships with that they don't have problems with turnover, right? Like they're not having problems that a lot of people are because they really nailed and invested in the people side. And that's not just like a on-off decision, right? Sometimes we have business models that are not built around, right, investment in the people side of the business. And so people have to like, in some ways, like retrofit their business model to change their priorities in these spaces. But I think that's a hugely important frontier as we move forward to kind of transition how we think about labor in our industry, its career orientation, you know, the effect it has on individuals and communities, et cetera. So I like that we're in a space where we're not just like telling people like, guess what, you guys, there are barely any Black people here, right? Like, because I think that's like I think that's where we started. And I think now, you know, we're in a place where we're like, okay, well, let's talk about like, how does this affect your P&L, right? Like how, what is this investment going to get you in terms of like tangible and intangible ROI in 2 years, 3 years, five years? You know, the DEI space has matured. And I think that's exciting. We have a lot of opportunities to see like how making, you know, things like equity and social sustainability, you know, endemic to the industry, like making that like just what it means to do business in craft beer. Like I genuinely believe like sky's the limit there.
I think that's a good place to leave it. Dr. J, thank you so much for joining us for Tap Lines. This has been a wide ranging conversation. I appreciate you. And I'm sure our listeners appreciate you going the distance and not shying away from some of the tougher, more, you know, weightier questions. I had no doubt that you would ever shy away from the tough stuff. But for listeners who aren't familiar, now they have gotten a crash course in what it's like to be on the other end of a conversation with Dr. J. Jackson Beckham. Thanks again so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. You're welcome back anytime.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dave. It's always great to catch up with you.
Likewise. Take care. Tap Lines is recorded in Richmond, Virginia, and produced by yours truly and Darby Seaside, who, along with the talented Shane Farrick, composed our delightful soundtrack. Just listen to it. I also want to give a quick shout-out to the entire VinePair team, and especially co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Mellon, editor-in-chief Joanna Sherino, managing editor Tim McCurdy, and art director Danielle Grinberg, who designed our lovely Taplines logo. And of course, a big thank you to you, yes you, listener, for spending time with us week in and week out. We literally couldn't do this without you. I'm Dave Infante, and I'll catch you next time.